Call the meeting of Senate Special Committee on Energy to order. Let the record reflect that it's 1:15 p.m. on Thursday, February 19th, 2015. We're in the Butchovich Room, 205. We have a quorum to do business. Co-chair Bishop is with us, Senator Egan, and co-chair Machicki, myself. Like to recognize our committee staff. First of all, Lynn Smith, who is my committee staff, and then Christopher Dickrell from Senate Records and Jessica Hines from LAO staff. Please turn off your cell phones. I'm going to check mine first. And purpose of our meeting today is to have two presentations. One is by Xcel Energy, and it's a collaborative approach to unified system operation for the Rail Belt region. And we wanted to start learning about how a build-out could look in a place in Alaska that might need some additional distribution services. So NSTAR is here to do that for us here later on today. So we'll begin with Xcel Energy. We have 45 minutes scheduled for this. I actually have a bill up in another committee, so I'm going to hand the gavel over to my co-chair here, and then I'll be back as soon as my presentation is done in the other committee. But we can get started, and I don't have to leave for 10 minutes. So if you can please join us and identify yourselves for the record, and start at will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Teresa Mogensen. I am Vice President of Transmission for Xcel Energy. I'm joined by my two colleagues.
My name is Daniel Klein, Director of Strategic Transmission Initiatives for Xcel Energy.
And I'm Cheryl Bredenbeck, Director of Investment Development for Xcel Energy.
Thank you for inviting us to speak with you today. We appreciate being here. We understand that Alaska is on a journey to transform and better integrate its electrical energy infrastructure to be able to extract the full value out of your past investments and pave the way for future growth. We believe we have some perspective and experience and resource that could be helpful to you. And our presentation today will cover a little bit about Xcel Energy, our understanding of the Alaska Rail Belt situation, our experience in leading collaborative transmission development, and some thoughts on possible next steps. And please feel free to ask any questions at any time. Xcel Energy, as shown on this slide, is a major integrated utility in the lower 48. We have four operating companies that are in the different colors that are shown on there that operate in eight retail states, and we have transmission in 10 states, as you can see in the north and the south midsection of the country. We have generation, transmission, distribution, and gas services. We are a number one wind energy provider, so we have a strong renewable energy bent, top five in energy efficiency programs, and emission reductions.
Ma'am, could you please go back a slide?
Mr. Chair.
Kind of strong on legends here. What are we looking at?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I didn't quite hear that.
What does red mean? What does yellow mean?
Oh, I'm
what
sorry about that.
Mean?
Yes. That is our operating company territory. Our legend must have dropped off of this slide. Our operating companies under Xcel Energy, we have four operating companies. The green is our Northern States Power Minnesota companies, which consists of our operations in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. This is showing our retail territory. We do have transmission assets outside of the retail service territory. The yellow in Wisconsin is our Northern States Power Wisconsin, Wisconsin and a little bit of Upper Peninsula Michigan. The red is our Public Service Company of Colorado operating company, and the gold in the panhandle of Texas and southeastern New Mexico is our Southwestern Public Service operating company.
And blue just means that you have something at least touching that state.
The blue is states that we have transmission assets in as well. So we have two states where we have transmission assets where we do not have retail service, and that is Oklahoma and Kansas, in addition to the states where we do have retail.
Okay. Thank you.
A little bit about Xcel Energy Transmission, our transmission function. We are an industry leader in transmission. We have a system in that territory that we showed on the prior slide that's comprising about 19,000 line miles, 1,200 substations, the assets in 10 states. We do operate under two RTOs, stands for Regional Transmission Organizations. And our north and our south entities operate in the Regional Transmission Organization. Those two are called MISO, the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator. SPP is the Southwest Power Pool. Our Colorado utility does not operate under a Regional Transmission Organization in the west. We do also operate under three NERC regions. NERC stands for North American Electric Reliability Corporation. This is the organization that governs reliability standards performance. We are in the process of implementing $4.5 billion. Thank you.
Question,
yes,
for you. You're Ms. Mogensen, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
The title talks about unified system operations, and in your slide number three talks about one independent system operator. What is the difference between the two?
The concept, Mr. Chair, is essentially the same whether it's unified system operator or independent system operator. The concept of that is an entity, and we have a slide a little bit later in the presentation, that has independent operational system control and oversight. So the transmission owners and generation owners operate under an independent system operator. The independent system operator or unified system operator has a single tariff, a single rate for transmission costs for moving power anywhere in that system, and dispatches all of the generators that are part of that system. So regardless of who owns the generators or who owns the transmission, the unified or independent system operator governs the overall operation.
Okay. I guess I was thinking more of which one of them is more likely to, my understanding is that a unified has a tendency to make the largest company the strongest, and an independent has the ability for you to put more controls in place where smaller companies are not disadvantaged. Would you agree with that?
I would say that, Mr. Chair, that there are different ways of setting that up. In general, in our experience in the lower 48, the independent system operators are in fact independent, meaning that they have a board that does not consist of any participants or members of the organization. The members are involved in electing the board, but the board members are all independent of those organizations.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. I'd like to announce Senator Stedman has arrived. You have a question?
No, Mr. Chairman. I was just didn't want to interrupt the presentations while I sat in here.
You may continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We also, before I leave slide three, Xcel Energy does have quite a significant capability in transmission, construction, operation, and planning, et cetera. We do have a large capability, including our own in-house capabilities, as well as our partner suppliers of materials and services, and we are executing a $4.5 billion investment program. So we have economies of scale and capabilities that we are happy to bring in play to assist Alaska. On this next slide, we have just a number of things to kind of show that we have we're coming from a place of some common values and experiences with respect to our Xcel Energy, different aspects and the things that Alaska is focusing on and working on right now. With respect to the effort to establish an independent system operator or unified system operator, we have experience with that in starting up a number of similar organizations in the states that we operate in. We are able to bring that to speed your implementation. Major build-out programs, you're looking at the rail belt. We have done similar large build-outs. We will be talking about one of those shortly as an example of the way to collaborate and get that done with each utility participating and maintaining some autonomy, but getting it done together. Generation diversification. Transmission is often the means to enact ability to diversify your generation or integrate renewables. We have direct experience with similar efforts in the states that Xcel Energy operates in. And as an example on renewables integration in Colorado, we have a significant forecasting system to manage the integration of significant amount of wind energy there. And we're also focused on conservation and community, as are you. So coming from the spaces, we hope to be able to align with the direction and provide you some of the benefit of our experience. I'll turn over to my colleague Dan Klein for the next section.
Before I, it is a good break for me to leave as well. Just wanting, it's very early in our process. I wouldn't say we're heading in that direction. I'd say that we're beginning to investigate whether or not all the entities could work together collaboratively. I think that's the basis of moving forward. So a lot of different sizes of utilities, a lot of different levels of investment, some fairly new investment. Some folks are very worried and probably should be. So I would just keep that in the back of your mind as this discussion continues, that it really depends on everybody coming to the table somewhat equally and having their own interests protected. And I understand the value. I've certainly directed folks. I had a bill this year that I pulled back because I believe that work is being done. I'm encouraging that folks get to the table and operate particularly generation and transmission infrastructure as efficiently as possible, and that requires that we move forward on this. But remember the little guys in this discussion, because that's what's going to start folks resisting us moving forward, I think. But with that, I'm going to hand it off to Co-Chair Bishop here, and I'll be back when I can. Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did we lose Senator Stedman?
No, we're here.
Okay. All right, please continue. And Daniel, you're up, right? You're before we segue off to that, I want to ask a question, if I might, on the back end of Senator Michicki's comment. We talk about value. So, you know, you have done some ISO models somewhere.
Yes,
right?
Mr. Chair. Yes.
A couple, right? Did I hear you that you...
We have been involved in those, yes. We do not run the ISO
right.
ourselves.
But you've got them there.
Absolutely, yes.
The execution. What's the... Can you tell me what the delivery price of electricity was before the ISO was set up and what the delivery price of electricity was after the ISO was set up?
Mr. Chair, I do not have those figures right at the tip of my tongue here, but that is
That's
information
fine.
We can probably provide.
I think the committee would like to see that examples of those two areas, because as Senator Michicki said, it's about value. And I think we're all trying to get there for our customers and our electrical utilities, right? So, thank you.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, my name is Daniel Klein with Xcel Energy, Director of Strategic Transmission Initiatives. Our understanding of the current state of the Alaska Rail Belt system is that it is essentially the result of individual utility system planning. Utilities have the obligation to ensure that their customers' needs, their demands are met, and the fact that they have individually planned is not an indictment of their methods or the utilities themselves. It's simply just a recognition that they were doing what they needed to do in the absence of a more coordinated approach.
Could I 50 years ago, you needed all these little independent power producers, right? And so I just summed it up there real quick for you. Today is a new day.
Thank you.
Sorry, continue.
Thank you. We are aware as well that customers have cost concerns. Some customers, generally speaking, pay a monthly utility bill that is higher than their mortgage payment. The governor has also cited concerns with the cost of energy for all Alaskans, citing the rail belt as well as rural Alaskans. The solution to these issues is a reliable, dependable regional transmission system with the dispatch of energy on an economic basis to ensure that the least cost energy is flowing to Alaska consumers. The utilities seem to have begun the formative steps toward establishing or making progress toward some sort of unified system operator approach. The House Special Energy Committee heard a presentation from the CEO of a relatively new organization called ARCTEC, Alaska Railboat Cooperative Electric and Transmission Company. This was just last week, where they discussed the guiding principles that the utilities have established for formation of some sort of a unified system operator approach in the rail belt. I won't belabor the guiding principles themselves, except just to say that the principles that they've formed are sound. They reflect principles that are consistent with our experience elsewhere in the country, and they reflect a necessary foundation to moving the energy discussion forward in Alaska. The unified system operator or independent system operator approach is a necessary step to ensuring that those economic benefits are realized. Another necessary step would be that reliable and dependable electric transmission system. Some study efforts have identified projects already that can help address some of those transmission needs. One plan that was conducted by the Alaska Energy Authority and identified approximately $903 million of transmission upgrades with an aggregate benefit cost ratio of 3.4. So that's 3.4 times benefits in excess of costs. These are significant benefits that demonstrate that targeted strategic upgrades to the transmission system in Alaska can deliver significant benefit to Alaska customers. Finally, we'll talk a little bit more about support needed from policymakers, legislators, regulators, other state leaders in a little bit. One important fact is to ensure that the RCA is empowered with clear authority to enact the goals that the legislature establishes. Historically as well, some funding for a lot of major energy infrastructure projects has come from state resources. In order to break free of that mold in light of the state budget constraints that we're currently under, new financing models are necessary. So support for some of those non-traditional financing approaches will be needed as well. Finally, the last point that I want to raise is Alaska will and can implement something that is unique to its needs and unique to its situation, but there are certainly lessons to be learned from elsewhere in the country. The solutions can be unique, but be sure we need to be sure and find the right solution based on other implementations elsewhere. And I'll turn it over to Cheryl Bredenbeck to bring some discussion of one particular case study that we have executed.
Welcome, Cheryl.
Thank you. So my section is about our case study of our CapEx 2020 project that was organized in the states of Minnesota, parts of Wisconsin, and the North and South Dakota. And this predated over 10 years ago, where enough for utilities all the entities that own transmission in that area were trying to get organized. They knew projects needed to be built, but they just were not coming together and organizing because everybody was worried about giving up control. They had their obligation to serve, and that those interests were paramount. So we see a similar staging here as what we experienced in the Midwest. So as the time went on, there was also uncertain revenue recovery, which was a driver, and that continued to paralyze transmission growth. And as the time built, the constraints were starting to affect business development and growth, generation diversification. There was a big push for renewables, very wind-rich area, and it was increased, and the market was starting up. There was increasing congestion, which created disparity in energy prices. And so there was a lot of coalescing in trying to get state and federal policies to a tipping point to understand where legislators could implement public policy and the regulators could actually execute it. So what the coalescing moved toward was creating CapEx 2020. And it started out, it was a very collaborative approach, starting out with four utilities, looking at, let's figure out how to build these projects together. Let's not look for someone else to come down and hand a solution. And what, starting with the four utilities, expanded out to include the electric cooperatives in that area, three of them. There were municipal generation transmission owners as well. And then finally the investor-owned utilities in that area. So there's a total of 11, and you see some of the brand names here who were part of that coalition. And so as this got off the ground, we took some of the lessons learned from past attempts and are trying to bring this forward to Alaska. And Xcel Energy did play the lead role in getting these projects implemented, and there were four projects. So let me give you an idea here on scope of these projects. It was actually $2 billion of investment done by these 11 entities. It was over 700 miles of 345 kV transmission and 70 miles at 230 kV, so pretty significant levels of investment, and the picture on the right shows where these additions were made. There was key alignment with regulators and policymakers to make this happen so you could get through the siting and permitting pieces of the projects. These projects were deemed very critical for the foundation for the current situation as well as preparing for the future. There was a no-regrets approach adopted in looking at future scenarios to ensure that they were building the right amount.
Question, ma'am?
Yes.
On this scenario here, this build out, $2 billion CapEx investment, over what time period was that? Is it several years, 10 years?
The investments, the construction investments themselves were made over a period of about 5 years. The projects were developed over a period of about a decade.
Okay. And one quick follow-up. So were you intimately involved with who was involved with the permitting? Anybody here?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the utilities were all involved, but Xcel Energy led many of the permitting efforts.
So how was your relationship with your federal permit agencies? You can be honest.
Mr. Chair, I believe that our relationship with the federal permitting entity is actually quite strong. We had one of our projects required a new crossing of the Mississippi River, mm-hmm. in the middle of an avian flyway, mm-hmm. which required a great deal of coordination with several federal permitting authorities, mm-hmm. in order to accomplish that.
Yeah, Mississippi not very big up there in Minnesota, though, is it?
It's about the crossing itself, Mr. Chair, is about a mile and a half wide.
Thank you. I crossed it somewhere where it was real small.
Further north.
Yeah, further north. Good. Thank you.
And then the last point on this slide is to make mention of the providing the transmission capacity to support the energy supply options that we're developing in the region. The pictorial on this slide kind of shows the structure of how these projects were established. Collectively, the group of 11 came up with core principles, and there was a management committee structure that all of these 11 participated in to build out these projects, and certain entities selected to be part of on one or more of these projects. You can see the affiliations by their branding, and each project had a set of agreements that went with it. And the projects themselves, historically, there's been like ownership of discrete lines. These projects were built more like in the pipeline model, where there was an investment, and then it correlated with a percentage ownership of the line.
Mm-hmm.
And there were four types of agreements: the ownership agreements, construction management, capacity exchange, and operation and maintenance agreements.
Please continue.
So, with regard to key success factors, with the coalescing of the 11 entities coming together, it really smoothed the way with the regulators and policymakers to actually move on to the construction process, and has proved to provide dividends today. The collaboration approach continues in our region. And as these projects are nearing completion, there was an economic study impact of these projects at $4 billion performed. And we continue to work with these folks today. One of the big drivers from the legislative process that helped move this along was a passing of a 2005 Omnibus Energy Bill, which included authorized return for construction work in progress, rider incentive for the investor-owned utilities, and a forward-looking rate recovery. Okay. And so now I can move on back to Teresa.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll comment based on your point at the beginning about the different sizes of entities, some small, some large. This CAPEX 2020 collaborative effort is very similar to that. It was large and small entities that all were able to come together through this approach and share in endorsing the regional facilities and then share in the ownership of those. Mm-hmm. So all the entities ended up with a seat at the table and an ability to invest in pieces of the combined infrastructure, and then it's been constructed and it's just about all going into service. Actually, this year the bulk of it will be in service, and all of it is administered under that independent system operator as far as going into being part of the regional tariff. Mm-hmm. and run on a system oversight control by that MISO, mm-hmm. one version of that. So it's just an example of how the transmission can get done in a way that involves all the utilities in the region and meets the goals that are set by the policymakers.
A question. When you went forward with this project, did you build your capacity, excess capacity in the line, or do you got room on the poles to add a line if you know what I mean? Did you build some expansion into the project?
Mr. Chair, we did work with our regulators to the extent that they wanted to authorize additional spend to allow for additional capacity. We did do that. In some cases, we built double circuit capable facilities and only installed the first circuit, mm-hmm. Leaving the other circuit available for future growth. So that was brought into the mix of the overall project cost.
Thank you.
So I will go into the last portion of the presentation, just talking a little bit about some thoughts that Xcel Energy has with respect to ability to offer a long-term partnership with the Alaska utilities and stakeholders to work with you to the extent that you are interested in transforming your transmission system and your overall infrastructure. We do have a lot of experience in developing these independent system operator organizations that we can bring to help you speed the implementation of yours. We are willing and interested to invest with the Alaska utilities to construct the facilities that are identified by your study efforts, the rail belt or your future regional study efforts that will bring some outside capital in to help alleviate any constraints that you may have. On an ongoing basis, we're willing to own transmission with the Alaska utilities along the lines of this CapEx 2020 model and also facilitate improvements in system operations. When you think about a roadmap to get there, one of the things, you know, is kind of clarifying what is meant by each of these different entities and how they all fit together. And on this slide and the next slide, we've just articulated the roles on this slide and kind of some of the tasks and approaches on the next. You know, it starts with the legislature, which is Alaska's energy policymaker. You set the policy direction for your state and then moves to usually a regulatory commission, in this case the RCA, who is your policy implementer. And in this case, should you choose to go this route, the RCA would, and I'll elaborate on the next page, create this unified system operator, independent system operator, which has the operational oversight and control. And so that doesn't mean that they're the entity that's running all the generators and running all the transmission lines on a day-to-day basis, but they are dispatching the generation and running the overall system to ensure that independence. Then beneath that you have the transmission owners who are investing in the transmission assets and running the transmission system, and the generation owners who are providing those energy supply options to the buyers. Those are all the people involved. If you look a little bit at the tasks by entity, if we run through from a legislature perspective, you set the policy to define the model that you want to have for Alaska. In this case, the rail belt electric system, and there is a report that will be coming out from the RCA, which is validating whether the savings that were calculated and the original rail belt report that came out in 2013, whether those are solid. And so that report will be coming out. You would then clarify the RCA's authority to implement the model that you choose and incent the utility participation. It would be important for all the utilities to participate to make that common tariff and common system approach work. From the RCA perspective, you'd be defining the specific attributes and implementing that USO, validate and adopt the rail belt plan. You'd set resource planning requirements if you chose to go that route, and set reliability standards. These two are often tasks of, in our experience, of commission sets. The unified system operator would then perform the economic generation dispatch, basically on a hour by hour basis, determining which is the set of generators that are going to together generate the least expensive power to meet the demand at any given time in consideration of the constraints on the grid for moving power around. That's economic generation dispatch. A unified transmission tariff would be a single cost for moving generation, moving power anywhere on that grid. The USO would also administer the revenue requirements associated with that tariff, so compensating all the owners for their assets and utilization. Administer a generator interconnection process and ultimately an ongoing regional transmission planning process. The transmission owners would construct, operate, and maintain the grid in accordance with whatever requirements were set from a reliability perspective. In the model that we have worked with, all the utilities have an ownership in the assets and have a role in the future transmission ownership. And then on the generator side, the generator owners negotiate power purchase agreements with the buyers, and they become a network resource, meaning agree to be dispatched by that USO. They would utilize the grid, pay that single transmission tariff, and respond to the real-time dispatch instructions. From an XL Energy perspective, we would be able to provide some of that experience to speed your implementation and also lead a collaborative investment approach to implement that rail belt plan with the Alaskan utilities. I would be happy, or any of my team, to take any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Senator Stedman? Senator Regan?
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
The floor is yours, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. So who would be responsible for the build-out or the requirements for the transmission lines? Would the RCA be responsible for that, or set the parameters, or what?
Mr. Chair,
or would the utilities?
Are you saying the standards for how the lines are constructed, or for which lines are constructed?
All the applicable requirements. I mean, is it the RCA's responsibility to define those, or would it be the utilities?
Usually the RCA would say this is the line, the lines that should be built, and establish that there's a need for those and direct the utilities to build them. The utilities would come up with, in general, a standard for how the lines should be done to meet whatever capacity that the lines were supposed to meet. This would be coming out of this study, you know, that says, okay, if you have these lines with this certain capacity, you're able to move the generation around and ultimately deliver some savings.
Okay, but in past, I mean, the RCA had final approval on, right?
In our experience,
and in this scenario,
yes.
It would still be the RCA?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? I have one. I just want a recap on my question to you folks, and is if you could get that information back to Chair Michicki and he could distribute it to the staff, but on a couple of examples of a couple of models where you've implemented this, the power rate to the meter before implementation and power cost to the meter after implementation. And I know it's not an apples for apples between Alaska and here, and there's a lot of variables, but just to, you know, if we can get a fit, you know, it would give us, I want to see if we're in the ballpark, you know, just what the savings are in Minnesota.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The probably the most significant difference would be going back to before you had an arrangement like this, mm-hmm. and once you put
right.
one into place, on an ongoing basis. There's usually an ongoing calculation of the value that has been brought on a collective basis for administering the power system in this way. But we'll pull together some information and supply that.
Senator Michicki's back, and I'm going to pass the gavel back to him, and I'm sure he would like to have a closing comment.
I don't really have missed most of it. I will study the presentation and contact you. I again, certainly before I support anything, I'm going to have to see a demonstration of a reduction in what ends up going to the ratepayer and not a convenience for utilities. As we already know, we've got five too many utilities operating in an area that serves the size of a medium-sized lower 48 city. And ultimately, someday, I'd like us to have one utility that operates the system. This might be a first step, but it goes the only way it works. I mean, I see that you're the one slide that has policymakers first. That's not the way we're going here. We've reversed that trend. It needs to be the utilities working together first, see if they can get come up with a collaborative path forward, and And if we need to help with policy, we're willing to do that. But when we start here, we sometimes have a tendency to move in a direction that's counterproductive to what's best for the ratepayers. In fact, essentially every time. I think it starts from the middle and then works in both directions. So I suggest working with the utilities and bringing us a plan. I'm more than happy to look at what you want to bring us on, how it's worked in other locations. Alaska is different in almost every way, but in some ways it's not, if you know what I mean. So I'm looking forward to see what you can provide, that's for sure. I think it's the right way to go if it begins with the right players in the room. Keeps us at accord, keeps everybody working together, you know. So any other questions? Okay, well, I want to thank you for being here today. And if we have any, we'll have a brief at ease. I want to thank all three of you for being here. I'm interested in learning more. And I know a lot of other folks are as well, so thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, committee members. We appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
Brief at ease. Thank you. We'll come back to order. Next, we have natural gas distribution build-out presentation by NSTAR, and we have President of NSTAR, Jared Green, and John Sims, Vice President of Corporate Resources and Business Development. And our interest here is just kind of understanding how it all starts. I mean, if there's a fledgling little effort to deliver natural gas somewhere in a company like yours that is successfully delivered natural gas all over the country in Canada. What would be the next steps? How would things get started? So that's kind of what we're asking here. So I'm going to hand it off to you, and if you can introduce yourselves for the record and start whenever you're ready.
Very good. Thank you very much. Jared Green, I'm the president of NSTAR Natural Gas. And?
John Simmons, I'm the vice president of corporate resources and business development.
So good afternoon today. Thank you very much for allowing us the opportunity to present and tell a bit of our story and hopefully let us provide a little bit of assistance to some of the processes that are on the agenda in front of some of the organizations before the committee. As a bit of a short background, NSTAR is an indirect, wholly owned subsidiary of AltaGas LTD. AltaGas is a diversified energy infrastructure company with assets focused on natural gas processing, power generation, and natural gas distribution. The company has five different distribution utilities across Canada and the United States. One of the utilities, Heritage Gas, is located in Nova Scotia on the east coast of Canada, and that's going to be a bit of the topic of today, where I'm going to walk the committee through some of our experiences with that build-out. Invariably, there will be many differences between our experience at Heritage Gas and what the state is facing with the development of the Interior Energy Project, but there will be a number of similarities as well. And so hopefully today the presentation can be of assistance and help out the Interior Energy Project as it proceeds forward. After I've gone through that, John will give a bit of an overview of a couple of the expansion projects within NSTAR and some of our experiences on how those have occurred in recent years and how they've unfolded. Before I go into too many of the details for our build-out, I am going to spend a couple of minutes just talking about the basic economic principles of being a rate-regulated utility. It's very important to highlight these principles. It frames the discussion for the utility economics. These economics are fundamental for the encouragement of investment into utility assets and also fundamental for the determination of the cost of service that the toll ends up being from a utility. Generally, a public utility is a natural monopoly. And with that natural monopoly, we are subject to rate regulation, which prevents kind of monopolistic control over the relationship between the utility and their customers. Basically, that relationship has a regulatory body which limits the revenue that a utility can charge to what is deemed to be a, we can go down to that, a just and reasonable rate. They have a goal to provide incentives for investment, but they're also trying to not unduly provide preferential, arbitrary, or unjust discrimination. So the goal of this is tariffs that are just and reasonable. And I do want to pause just a little bit on the term of reasonable. There is a basic definition of that as well. With reasonable is a rate commensurate to the service being received. And that's how it's determined within that view for what the utility regulations oversight is.
Question for you.
Yes, sir.
So is there a range of a rate of return that's typical? I mean, if you think about all in of your investment, how are they determined reasonable? And would that be different in a place like Nova Scotia or Southern California versus South Central or the interior of Alaska?
To the chair, absolutely. There's a large range, and it ends up being a fairly involved, and this is where the profession of PhD economists, I think this is actually what they do. I've always wondered what the job of a PhD economist is. They get very, very involved in cost of capital discussions, and you end up going through a very large process to look at the risks of an organization, because it is the risks that are facing a specific utility in the environment that they're operating in that really drives what would be considered to be a fair return on investment. For an investment such as Heritage Gas in Nova Scotia, it is still in its greenfield phase. It's in its infancy. And with that, there's a fair amount of business risk that comes with an entity. And in the first, this was 8 years of its operations, it had a return on equity of 13%. And that was deemed to be a return that would be commensurate to the risk of a new utility build-out.
3 years ago, that return on equity did drop by 200 basis points as Heritage Gas had attracted some more customers, reduced its overall business risk as it became a bit more of a viable entity. So we did see a reduction of the ROE as a result of it just becoming a bit of a mature, more mature business. Other examples on the ROE do stem up and come right up here to the Alaska environment. And when we look at the ROEs that NSTAR would have or that our other utility with SINGSA has, they're risks that are commensurate to operating in a northern environment where you're very far away from supply chains. It is difficult to get replacement products in. If we have pipes that need to be brought in on emergency measures because you have a damage or a hit on your line, it's much more difficult to get those lines brought in. We have significantly larger weather risk than what a number of the lower 48 companies would have. This past year and a half, we've really realized that on the NSTAR side. It's been, I know Fairbanks has had some cold, cold days, but we really have not realized that through the South Central area. So items like that all get factored in when looking at the risk of a company and really drive into what the ROE, a fair ROE would be determined for it.
And there was the Heritage Gas situation. Was there a similar regulating agency there?
Yes. So the Nova Scotia Utility and Review Board. So very, very similar regulating body to what the RCA is. Very similar mandate. And compared to what NSTAR and SINGSA have, which is a cost of service rate of return regulation, which is pretty much the most common type of regulation for private utilities, so when you have private investors investing in. Nova Scotia has that same concept, that same model, so the economic fundamentals are very, very similar to what we have up here in Alaska. And for AltaGas's other three utilities, we are also in cost of service rate regulated models for those. So it is a very common practice for private utilities. And actually, that line of questioning really stems into kind of the next little point through here of just general for utilities. Utilities can be privately owned or they can be publicly owned as well. Publicly owned utilities include co-ops. They also include municipal or government-owned utilities. From a co-op utility, that's where the utility is owned by the customers of the exact utility. Private utilities are also considered to be investor-owned utilities. And for NSTAR, and from my experiences, that's really where our role has been. And so that's going to be a lot of where I'm going to be talking about is from an investor-owned base. I'm going to spend just a couple more moments walking through the regulatory process, and we will touch a little bit. I won't spend a ton of time on the ROE because we have already addressed that a little bit. But when you go through a regulatory process to determine these just and reasonable rates, it ends up being a very, very involved and transparent process where the Commission, in a very public form, gets to look at almost all financial and operating information for a utility. So they do spend a lot of time really scrubbing the intimate details of your operations. And they go through that process basically in two fashions. I like to refer to them as a phase one and a phase two step to their regulatory process. The phase one step is determining the allowed annual return for an investor-owned utility. This is basically looking at, from a very holistic perspective, what would be reasonable revenue for a utility to earn. And on the slide, I've kind of broken up, it ends up being very, very backwards from what a normal Walmart, McDonald's, normal traditional private business would be, where you really start with your top line revenue, you knock off your expenses, and that's what you're left over with your returns. For rate regulated utilities, it ends up being a bottom-up approach, and it comes down to you're afforded an opportunity to earn a fair return on the investment you made. So you look at the amount of dollars that have been invested into the utility, and then a total return is determined on that. So as an example, if $100 million was invested into a utility, you'd say, what would be a fair return on that $100 million investment? I'll actually jump a little bit here on this piece. For that $100 million investment, they'll also look at how should you be capitalized for a reasonable company operating with a similar risk to what you're looking at. So they do split it between a debt and an equity component. And along the lines of where the chair's question was asking, was really focused on the ROE, which is the portion of the investment which is assumed to be funded by shareholder funds. But it is also assumed that a prudent business would set up a capital structure that has an appropriate mix of debt and equity. For NSTAR's perspective, we have about 51% of our capitalization is equity and 49% is debt. And that split also gets looked at very heavily through the regulatory process. And there's a lot of comparisons to what would entities with similar risk profiles capitalize themselves. It prevents entities from taking on too much leverage and having over-earning capabilities on the component of equity they may have in place. So they do put a lot of focus around the split between debt and equity. From a debt perspective, this ends up being what could the entity borrow the funds to finance. In my example, it would be the $49 million, because if you had $100 million of total, $49 being debt, the other $51 would be considered equity.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
In this whole in this methodology that I think you've just done a marvelous job to so far explaining, gets us to the reasonable cost to the consumer. That's right.
To the chair, it gets us partway there.
Yep.
And actually, to get to the end cost to the consumer, we do need to go to would be the phase two portion.
Right. I mean, but I've already jumped ahead.
Oh, you're already on that guy?
But anyway, sorry. I'm ADD. But anyway, your slides are good. I'm sorry.
Just continuing, I'll tie up very quickly on this piece then. Once you've determined the total revenue from the return, your total operating costs, the recovery of your investment over time, which for utilities is a 30 or 40 year time span where you do recover your investment, that puts together the whole a bucket of revenue that an entity would be said to be, it's fair for you to recover these amount of costs. Then you go down to the phase two aspect and you look at it from a customer perspective. And you have many different types of customer. And so you take your whole bucket of costs and you try to allocate those costs to your different customer groups. And after that allocation, you end up with the toll to each of the customer types. And through this split, really large industrial customers, high volume customers, end up utilizing a huge component of your large transmission assets. They're the guys who really demand large-scale pipelines, large-scale mains. They need a lot of flow through the volume, but they don't utilize service lines. They don't utilize mains. So when you're looking at a cost causation perspective, the charge that would be allocated to those large customers would be a big component of your mains, your high-volume assets. They won't have much on the service lines. When you go over to your residential customers, they don't flow a huge proportion of the volume through your big lines, so they don't end up having as much of that cost allocated. But they're the ones who utilize service lines. They're the ones who have the meters on the houses. So those portions get allocated to those customers. And so it ends up just being a fair allocation based on who is driving the largest cost, which end results to the toll that the customer has for the distribution charge of natural gas. You'll note that I have not spoken at all yet to the actual cost of the molecules, because we are talking about the delivery service of the distribution.
So I have a little question for you, and someone who is very famous in this building once said to me that it's not fish companies that went into the fish business, it's can companies. They just stick a little bit of oil and some fish to sell you the cans, right? That they're kind of asking that question around natural gas. There's a nice return. Why aren't more people in the business? And I guess what I'm asking for is to, at some point, you'll explain many of the risks. It's not risk-free. It's a very risky business, and it might be a way for folks to understand why the potential companies we have for ways that we've directions we want to move. And we talk about the interior, but I mean, we have Seward in my district and other relatively compact communities that might also fall into this pool. Your return so far doesn't really capture risk a lot.
operational risk?
To the chair, the operational risk, when a company accepts the utility franchise, they do accept that with an economic obligation to serve. We do have an obligation to serve customers within our franchise areas as long as the expansion to those customers is not unduly burdensome on the rest of the system. So basically it has to be an economic expansion out. The risk that you're not able to attract additional customers on, you're not able to grow your business, if you're the risk of customers going off of your system, that is borne by the shareholder and the utility once they've accepted the franchise agreement. The risk of operating costs, if you have an outage in the middle of winter and you have to have some emergency repairs to a pipeline, if you have any sort of workforce costs that do flow through that weren't forecast or predicted, those are all borne by the company and the shareholder. And that's risks that those shareholders, they're willing to take on that risk if the approved ROE is commensurate for them taking on that risk. And a lot of that happens at the start of the relationship. And the regulatory compact, basically the agreement where a private entity is willing to come in and take on the franchise, they come in and they take that on knowing the playing field that's available, and they're willing to take on the risk of customer growth maybe not coming to the table. They're willing to take on gas cost risk of if gas costs were to have a complete flip-flop over the price of fuel oil, and now fuel oil is the value proposition versus gas, and all of a sudden you have customers converting back because it's a cheaper source. Those types of risks are borne by the shareholder in exchange for that return on equity that we talked about before. And it's where that initial handshake to come in and where that fair return on investment is a very important factor for attracting capital, is there are a lot of risks of operating and running these businesses that once you come in the door, you do have an obligation to your customers. And to the chair's comment of not a whole lot of companies are getting into the game, companies who get into the business of natural gas distribution generally stay around for a very, very long time. And the operators of those companies are operators who are with the company for 30, 40 years and are really, really tied in with that. It's a difficult piece to get into. It's a high risk to overcome. Once you're in, you've come up with an agreement that you are going to be serving those customers. And that's where the importance of that regulatory compact, you can call it the handshake, where a fair return in exchange for investing into the community growth occurs.
Okay.
So from the regulatory theories, I think we've covered off that. So now I will pass over to some more fun of the discussion. And flipping over to our expansion into Heritage Gas, and then tell a story a bit about this investment. AltaGas has been an investor in Heritage Gas since 2002. We have been the sole owner of it since 2009. So we'd originally developed it off with two partners and then acquired the full interest in 2009. As I noted before, Heritage Gas was a greenfield distribution utility. The path to Heritage Gas's birth is one that was cruxed on the construction of the Maritimes Northeast Pipeline. And it was a 30-inch pipeline that was constructed to bring gas from the Sable Island offshore facility down to Drake it to the Boston market. That was the core piece for that facility to come in. But there were a couple of laterals that were built off of the facility. And one of the laterals was built to feed Nova Scotia Power's Tufts Cove power plant, a little over 400 megawatt power plant, smack in the middle of the Halifax regional municipality. So we had a big line coming in to feed gas to Boston. Then we had a nice sized lateral that was feeding a very large power plant. With that infrastructure in place, Heritage Gas was able to spawn. Without that infrastructure and without that secure, reliable gas supply coming to town gate, Heritage Gas's start, it wouldn't have happened. That pipeline was absolutely necessary for us to start the company out. We have grown the company along and in near proximity to that pipeline. Communities such as Amherst, which is just off the Maritimes Northeast Line, we've expanded to that in early years. We've had good expansion out at the Halifax Airport. And then the Halifax-Dartmouth area, that's the big core municipality. That's where the significant expansion has occurred. We have invested, over that 10-year period, $220 million into the business. Tying back to the earlier slide, that would be the total investment in, and then when we do have the split between your debt and equity, that would be applied to the 220. So 220 is the total investment, and then we have an equity component and a debt component of that. We have installed about 260 miles of mains. We have, after the 10 years, 5,000 customers attached. We're flowing about 6.5, just a little over 6.5 BCF of gas a year. We have had decent success on the penetration for the industrial and the commercial customers. I will say on this, our residential customer penetration was the largest surprise that we've had in this entire build-out, and it hasn't been anywhere near what we had originally expected or envisioned. It's been a lot slower to get our residential customer conversion on.
Are there any public funding entities on? I mean, there's a couple questions to ask about conversion, right? How close is it to the price of heating oil? What other options do they have other than heating oil? And is there an entity that's willing to help with the cost of conversion? I mean, we have an organization called ADA here. If they were financing, you know, low-cost financing for conversion, did they have something like that in the Nova Scotia Heritage Gas situation? So I asked you three questions.
To the chair, we'll see if I get all three on that or not. There is some small funds available from an energy conservation program, which is aimed at lowering the greenhouse gas usage, and that will fund a portion of the homeowner's conversion, and then those funds have been available to some portions of the commercial entities. There's been a lot of risk in recent years of those funds no longer becoming available. There are limited funds for expansion. There has not been any government contribution for the system build-out for this utility. So it has purely been funded with the investor investment, and the tolls that the customers are paying are reflective of the full invested cost on it. And there has not been a subsidy coming out on this example. Compared to some of our other utilities, our Alberta utility as an example, very, very different story on that. In the build-out within Alberta through the 60s and 70s, there was a significant amount of government contribution to build out our rural network. So it does depend on the cases and the situations, but for Heritage Gas, we haven't had a whole lot of overall government subsidies on that end. From the competitive fuel source, overall, for the Nova Scotia marketplace, fuel oil number two is still the most prominent fuel source for consumers, followed by propane, then followed by, fuel oil number two, followed by electricity, and then propane and wood are three and four, and natural gas is still number five in the marketplace for the fuel oil choice. But in 2013, for the little over 5,000 customers that we had, our customers had $73 million worth of savings versus what their fuel costs were prior to converting to natural gas. So there are significant savings available compared to the fuel oil number two, which is the most common conversion. But even from a residential perspective, it is a difficult hurdle to overcome the conversion cost for your home. There's some funds available, but it's not a huge amount on that end. We are finding that as people's heating systems do break down and wear out, we're having decent track records on attaching them. New communities, we do have better success on new home builds of getting penetration on that end. We're not perfect on that. We still do have a lot of competition from some of the electric heat pumps for taking over the natural gas load. And they're able to, on this end, it ends up being some pretty tight negotiations with the home builders as to who can provide the home builder a better subsidy. And we are finding that electric is making a little bit of inroads on that end. It ends up being a challenging battle on that conversion front. But the big story in this is we are growing. The $73 million of savings through 2013 are very significant. So the customers who have converted, especially our large commercials, our hospitals, our schools, there's been huge, huge savings that have occurred from those entities. The slide which we're showing right now is the growth and then also the penetration.
Well, so, I just might note one of the emergency management issues in the interior, particularly Fairbanks, is the greenhouse gas emissions. So that conversion also saved 200,000 tons of, I mean, tons is spelled wrong, but you Canadians are funny that way.
That's equivalent to 240?
1.1 conversion.
Yeah, okay, 220 tons with no extra N or E.
Okay.
Sure.
Pretty significant in the interior case here. Anyway. Nope. Yes, Senator Egan.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So is the power generation of the electricity, is it through natural gas or is it through hydro or what's it from?
Through the chair, the main power generation through Nova Scotia is a mix of natural gas power generation. There is coal generation, and there is still a few plants of the peaker plants that are still burning fuel oil number two. But there is a good load of natural gas fired plants as well.
Thank you.
Did Maritimes and Northeast production ever come on like they expected?
To the chair, early on, the Sable Island was producing very much as was expected. It has declined off significantly in recent years, and the number of years left off that platform it's fairly limited. There has been another offshore platform called Deep Panuk, which is in Canaplay, that has come on over this last year. So there's some new gas coming into the pipeline, but it won't be there forever. However, at some point in time, gas may end up having to go south to north instead of its traditional north to south. They are still connected to the North American grid, which is a very, very nice place to be from a security of supply perspective of being able to access. It may cost you because getting gas to go past the Boston market can be extremely expensive, but the actual security of knowing you can truly get those molecules is a nice place to be.
So one of the reasons I brought that up is the fact that demand also creates a market for exploration and production. And there are some folks at Cook Inlet that worry about future supply, even though we've sort of turned that whole outlook around pretty dramatically in the last couple of years. So I mean, the point I've been making since we began this discussion is Fairbanks and that, particularly the densely populated or the heavy industrial areas of Fairbanks are a very attractive market. And as natural gas distribution expands, it increases the motivation for people to explore and produce, right? Would you call that a correct statement?
To the chair, I would agree with that entirely. If there is one thing that's kind of pretty clear for the E&P world, if there is demand, people will search out a way to supply that, and so it ends up being a very efficient market on that end. The next slide up, just won't dwell too far on this, but did want to point out, because it will be a topic of interest, the charge to the residential customers. And so this is out of Heritage Gas's February 2015, so these are the current rates that are being billed to the residential customers. Comes in at just under $20 an MCF, so it's at $19.24, plus a fixed monthly charge of just over $21. This is a toll that is reflective of the model that I described earlier, where there are costs that were incurred to build the system, to put the service lines, to put the mains, and this toll is a recovery of those costs. This toll is also one that did drive the $73 million of savings last year. It's a toll that's a higher toll than what NSTAR would have out of our local market, but we're looking at pipeline infrastructure that is being built from 2003 to 2014 versus pipeline infrastructure that was and the backbone that was built in the 1960s and 70s. So the toll does end up reflecting on that piece.
Questions? So what you're saying is this is more of an expected rate when you have comparisons to the build-out, but these are relatively high distribution charges and the cost of gas is higher. You're saying across the board it's, other than a fixed monthly charge, which may be, is that sort of like a meter rate? If you've got a meter, you're $21.87. If you've got a industrial or commercial meter, you're somewhat higher.
That's very much, it's representative of kind of the, it's supposed to be representative of a fixed charge on it. And it ends up just being the non-variable component. When I chatted earlier about the phase two, this is part of that phase two, and this ends up actually being a heavily negotiated piece. The true fixed components of the system are probably higher than what the $21.87 would reflect, but there's a strong customer demand to keep that fixed charge on the lower end and have more applied to the variable rate. So this is just where we've ended out on that end. There's a utility term called decoupling, which is, you can have decoupled from your gas cost, from your delivery charge, but you can also have decoupling within your delivery charges. And the greater your fixed monthly charge, the more you're decoupling variability from your service. Really, from a utility's perspective, that de-risks an investment, the higher you have your fixed charge, because then you're not subject to weather risk, you're not subject to conservation risk. From a customer perspective, they would desire less on that, to leave the utility at those risks. And that's, as far as contentious items within a phase two of a regulatory application, any utility across North America, this is an area that gets discussed.
So if you're at $19 plus the fixed monthly fee, that might be part of the challenge for conversion. And
It definitely comes into the factor for conversion, but even with that, that is and has been in recent years a significant discount versus the alternative of fuel oil, which is the most common competitor, and also a discount on propane. Where we're sitting today with the recent significant drop in oil, fuel oil too has dropped accordingly as well, and I would not be surprised if 2015 is a challenging conversion market as well, because now you're going to be looking across at, you're still going to have huge environmental benefits, but if there's not a true cost savings coming off of it, that will create a bit of a challenge on that end. That's while oil prices are low, even we're seeing them having recovered a little bit, but we're still back in the 60-ish range, I believe.
Yes, Senator Egan.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just I'm curious, what is the price per gallon of diesel number two?
Yeah.
On the East Coast, do you know?
I'm
just trying to relate it to here.
Through the chair, the local price for fuel is around $3. That's where we're sitting right now.
Okay.
So I'm not sure what it is in Halifax, but yeah.
Well, and you, just to be fair, you have to convert it on some other unit, like per million BTU or something. So it's probably around 22 or
if you convert it to MCF, yes,
right,
about
now.
22, 23 MCF.
Okay, thank you. Now I want to tell another little story within Heritage Gas. I touched before that we've really grown the business close to the large transmission line. But we have looked to expand out to communities that are not directly accessible by the normal transmission pipe. And these are communities that would be, or customers that are too far away to make a pipeline an economical investment to attach to. And we built out a CNG portion of the business, so a compressed natural gas. And we have a couple pictures up on the slides. The top picture is our mother station. So this is where you tap off the Maritimes Northeast Lateral. You compress the gas on these. You're compressing up to about 2,800 PSI within steel tanks, and we have some composite tanks that'll compress it up to about 3,600 PSI. And then you take it to the bottom right picture, which is the daughter station, and that's at one of our industrial customers, and you tap into their meter at that point, and you free flow out of your trailer and use the pressurization from the trailer. So it's been a nice little investment to be able to access some of the small communities that do have a core anchor load, so you do need your anchor industrial customer to warrant the investment of that daughter station and the trucks going back and forth. But it has been a decently successful kind of side part to the business and the ability to grow out a bit more of our customer base and bring some more natural gas to more people. I have no done there as well. It does come with additional cost because the facilities come with additional cost. You have the transportation of rolling back and forth. So we do have a $2.75 per GJ rate rider for all of our CNG customers. And so that's just an incremental charge that goes on top of our normal distribution charges. But it's looking at the creative methods to expand to some communities. Applying this idea and this methodology across some of our other businesses within AltaGas, we have looked at other various communities throughout Alaska, and it's may very well be that NSTAR does look to expand out to some areas where a CNG would make sense. You do have a limited range to utilize CNG because you don't have that much energy content per trailer, but it still could be a value proposition to the customer base. It really comes down to the cost of being able to transport it over, and then it would be the cost of building out that distribution system within that community as well. And at the end of the day, you have to have a value proposition to your customers to really make it make sense for them.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So what's the kilometer make or break point on delivery of CNG?
We have it at 180 kilometers, so sure. 110 miles is what our current expansion size on that. That has just grown, and it's grown with some advances in technology of the tubes. For the pictures, those are our steel tubes on all of the trailers that we have up in the pictures, and there are some new advances in some composite tubes that make the trailer lighter. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, you can only roll so much weight on the road, so you put as much gas in to fit for how much you're actually allowed to transport on the road. The composite trailers are significantly lighter than the steel, so then you're able to press them up higher and get more energy content per trailer. So you can get some additional percentages in with that, and that's where we're up to the 180-kilometer range for that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Regan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what do you consider a small community?
Through the chair, that is a very...
I mean, we have real small communities in Alaska. And then we have, you know, do you consider Juneau a small community of 35,000? I mean, what is your small community?
Through the chair, it's a very good question. These are my own personal classifications of it. I don't think I would classify Juneau as a small community. It's a larger area, and it would be an area that would have a significant amount of demand. And I may actually refer to John because he's done some work around what sort of demand would be present within the Juneau market. But a market such as a Seward market would probably be one that we'd within the classification that I'm speaking of here. That would be a smaller community, but one that's large enough that it could warrant facilities and pipelines going into the ground, potentially warrant the service tax that would be required in order to operate a distribution system, because you still need to have every bit of safety operations and everything that the entire NSTAR brand brings to the table, because the safe, reliable service, no matter where we're at, it cannot be at risk, and it must be part of our delivered service.
One more question, Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
So these CNG vehicles that you've designed, can they be transported by barge? And then it would get rid of your 109-kilometer distance, right?
Through the chair, yes, they absolutely could. And going back, there has been some old gas supply discussions many, many years ago within the state of when we were looking at some concerns within Cook Inlet, where CNG on a larger scale on barges was looked at as a potential supply alternative. So yes, they can be done on a larger scale. And for our experience on the 180-kilometer limitation, that's an economic limitation is what's creating that. The cost of transportation at some distance becomes prohibitive where it's no longer a value add. So for the barging solution, it would be the variable cost of the barging would create its limitation.
But if your tugs are LNG or CNG, that would save you a lot of money.
So I think something that's missing in the discussion is that you kind of have to, and this was a goal of our committee this year, I'm not sure how far we'll get by the end of the session with all the budget issues going on, but we have a tendency to pick one direction in Alaska, and often it's the wrong one. And then we throw a lot of money at that same decision for years and get further off base every time. So what we're hoping people do is kind of pull back and say, for various communities, is it propane or CNG or LNG or a pipeline? Which works the best? How do the economics work out? The more we're in the way of some of these decisions, and this has been a point, I think when you look at a market like Fairbanks, I think we're at the point where someone's probably willing to take on that market if we would just sort of get out of the way and let them evaluate the costs and move forward from there. And others, we're going to have to be involved in some subsidies that bring down the cost of energy to those communities. But I think it's time to have that discussion. We have a goal of 25% renewables by 2025 for power generation, and we're in the low 20-something percent now if you put everything into one great big portfolio. We'll see if we get there, but I think statewide we have to have these discussions. So I was hoping to start part of that today about what it might look out for a build out in a hypothetical Alaska community. Of course, I gave two examples. One was Fairbanks, the interior, and the other was Seward. Seward's considerations might look a lot like Fairbanks or like Juneau or Sitka or one of those other coastal communities that might have coastal deliveries of propane, CNG, or LNG one day, you know. But certainly those are the discussions we need to start having. Certainly.
Hey, Mr. Chair, it brings up another question. So what, and maybe you don't know this, and what is the average price per kilowatt electrical in your region? Do you know?
Through the chair, I believe it's in the 10-cent range, but it continues to go up here as well.
Is that the commercial rate or
No, that's the residential rate.
Okay.
It varies. I believe Chugach may be less, but I don't off the top of my head. So we did want to also provide a local example, and with NSTAR, Homer was an example that we thought was a good one of state and local governments working together with the utilities to serve a community. And before I get into the distribution system, I want to talk a little bit about how we got gas to the market in the first place, because I think that's a good background. NSTAR had the certificate to serve the Homer area for a number of years, and the main challenge was finding a reliable and secure source of natural gas to serve the community. When we originally got the service territory, we envisioned it to be an isolated distribution system because of how far away it was from the existing distribution and transmission systems for natural gas. So we had a couple options. The producers ultimately fell through and we weren't able to deliver. And so we kind of put it on the shelf until 2009, where the dynamics really changed. Anchor Point Energy came in, found a commercial amount of gas in the North Fork unit. In order to get that natural gas to the market, NSTAR extended its transmission system 21 miles from Nanochek down to Anchor Point so that it could access that natural gas. And that really made a pipeline to Homer potential. The city of Homer and Kachemak City, once they saw that extension of the transmission line, contacted us and asked for an estimate on what it would be to get gas down to the Homer area. We provided that estimate. It was about $10 million. The city of Homer then came to the state and lobbied for some support and some capital dollars to help assist in bringing down that cost. Ultimately, they were successful. The city of Homer was granted with $8.15 million to help go towards a trunk line to bring gas to the Homer area. Once that plan was in place, we were able to start looking at a distribution system and the potential of serving that area. And again, the city of Homer and Ketchikan City came to NSTAR. They asked for a complete system cost estimate for the build-out of distribution main. On first glance, it was about 70 miles. The estimate was around $15 million for the city of Homer. And for Ketchikan City, it was about 9 miles, and about $1.5 million was the estimate for that extension. The city then, the city of Homer first, took it upon themselves to go to the voters. They developed what's called a HSAD, or Homer Special Assessment District, which is a way of assessing individual property owners a certain percentage of the project cost to recover that and then contribute to the project. They sent out ballots to 3,855 property owners, of which only 540 voted against the project. The assessment was estimated to be about $3,200 per lot, and ultimately that gave them the authority to go to the borough, the Kenai Peninsula Borough. They took a loan from the borough and then paid NSTAR on a time and materials basis for the installation of the distribution system.
Senator Egan. Mr. Chair, so was the concept like a local improvement district? Did they create an LID?
Through the chair, Senator Egan, that's exactly it. Yeah, they just have a different name for it down in the Kenai Peninsula.
Oh, the USAD.
USAD in the Kenai Peninsula Borough. It's the local improvement district up in the Matsu. Yeah.
But here it would be.
And here it's.
And that's with an LID.
Exactly. Okay. Yes. Yes. And it's very common in many jurisdictions for extending public service. And so. NSTAR installed 70 miles of distribution main in 2 years, and total project cost was $12.1 million. In the Ketchikan City example, the city of Ketchikan decided to pay themselves for the installation of the distribution system, 9 miles. Total cost ended up to be $1.2 million. In addition to that, to drive the conversion rate, they actually paid their residents $500 per receipt for a service line and meter set application. And the participation they had was phenomenal in that community. I believe it was nearly 100% as far as the conversion rate in Ketchikan City. The conversion rate that we're seeing in the city of Homer is very good for a 2-year time frame. It's about where we would expect it to be at year 5 if it were through the normal private main extensions. We have about 1,300 customers in the city of Homer out of about 2,500, so a little more than half. We also have a number of customers that have paid for their service line and for their meter set, however, they haven't converted yet. And we're still looking to understand why that hasn't taken place, whether or not it's the upfront cost of converting. We do know that there is a significant shortage of plumbing contractors in the area, which presented some challenges. So we're looking to understand that, but for the most part, it's we're anticipating anywhere from a 60% to 70% conversion rate.
Senator Bishop.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Burner tip price in Homer?
To the chair, the rates for Homer are postage stamp rates just like anywhere else on NSTAR's system, with the exception of a $1 per MCF surcharge. That dollar per MCF surcharge goes to pay off the remainder of the project cost from the $10 million estimate that we gave you and the difference between the 8.15 that the state paid. So they are paying that $1 MCF until we have received the full contribution for that trunk line portion, the 22-mile extension from Anchor Point to Homer. So they're paying about $11 per MCF.
Thank you.
Yes.
That's with the dollar added for
funding. That is including the dollar.
Other questions?
No.
Okay. Just a couple of personal stories from constituents. I had Homer Wallach expansion. I think the expansion essentially took place in 1 year.
To the chair, it was a 2-year expansion. We had kind of the city core in the first year, and then the outer areas and the spit in year two. Ketchikan City was done in year one.
I guess I should say the trunk line was a 1-year project that connected Homer with the rest of the system. What was the diameter of that trunk line?
Was it? To the chair, it was an 8-inch and a 6-inch. So it started off as 8-inch. Once it got into the city, went down to a 6-inch all the way through to Ketchikan City.
Okay. Some of the stories are people that reduce their heating. A person that we just spoke to yesterday that is applying to be a Marine pilot went from hundreds and hundreds of dollars a month to a couple hundred dollars a month to heat his home. He's a nice home with a lot of windows. It has a very high energy rating, but some very happy people. I think the expansion of conversion there really has become a neighbor-to-neighbor thing. A lot of folks that fought it, and there's some folks that have just decided they're done with hydrocarbons, and they remember, oh wait, heating oil is a hydrocarbon too, I'll go ahead and convert, and their results have been pretty phenomenal. So I think you're almost going to see a steamrolling effect until you finally get to those folks that have paid for the meter. That, when I've talked about this with you two offline, that you really have to get the price of natural gas to the point in order for you to have the an accelerated build out that makes your project work. You have to have the price of natural gas to the point of where even senior citizens see the benefit of conversion, right? If you get to the point where only 30-year-olds are converting, we don't have the, we're upside down on the math. So I think what I want to do today is get people to think about all those little pieces that go into conversion, because it doesn't magically show up. There's a cost to it. But it really does have to work mathematically, financially, before you're going to get the conversion rates you want. The other thing he talked about that I thought was pretty important was the fact that industrial users really generally pay the bulk of initial service, and everyone after that almost essentially gets a better deal, right? Is that theoretically how it works?
The core on the expansion is having a large anchor customer coming in is the underpinning of the expansion out. It's not so much that the other customers coming on are getting a discount or a deal from it. They're getting the benefit of the scale that large customer brings in and the sharing of that cost. And so they're not getting subsidized necessarily by the large customer, but without that large customer, they would be bearing kind of the unavoidable cost of putting a distribution line out to an area.
Senator? Or they might not even have a project without the anchor tenant.
To the chair. Most likely, your point is absolutely perfect.
Mm-hmm. To the chair, in those smaller communities that don't have industrial load, you're looking at the high schools, the shopping malls. Those can be the same kind of concept as far as extending main throughout the system if you've got a larger customer on the end of the main that can bring it to other folks. So that's the case in the smaller communities.
Right, so even for municipalities, I believe in the 2 years that it took us to secure the funding, that last 2 years, we would have saved $2 million just on municipal buildings in the Kenai Peninsula Borough for fuel costs. So that was really the bigger push, is getting everyone to realize that it affects everyone in that municipality, which is folks from, you know, the costs were realized by everyone from Seward to Seldovia, really, everybody in the borough. So it benefited everyone on bringing those costs down for the municipal structures. Any other questions? We may want to have you back. This is a good discussion. What I'm going to try to do is get all the players that might take a role in getting, when you talked about a reliable source of natural gas to the interior, I personally think that there's an interim way of getting natural gas to the interior, and then there's a permanent, reliable way to get natural gas to the interior. You know, I've been pushing pipeline transmission to Fairbanks and in the interior, so I'm probably going to, we may have you back, and we may ask you to talk about how those pieces might need to come together in the future if something like that was going to happen. And I think starting this discussion will bring some smaller coastal communities to the table that know that someday conversion, if they are on a path of delivery, reliable delivery, whether it's pipeline or in more remote places, CNG, LNG, I think we might get some folks excited about that potential. We know that number two is not going to stay at $3 forever. We've seen 5 and 6, and in remote communities in Alaska, we've seen 7 and 8, and those are coming back at some point. We need a reliable long-term solution. So thank you very much for being here today, and I thank Excel for being here today. So with that, if there are no other questions, is there any follow-up you'd like from NSTAR, Senator Regan? No? Okay.
Good presentation. Yep.
Thank you. We are adjourned at 2:55 p.m., and we'll get announcements out for the next meeting in advance. Thank you.